Greetings and salutations, excellent listeners, and welcome to this February 2012 Science News Update. I'm your host for this astounding, surreal, and endlessly titillating science podcast, Jim Campanella. This is the first month in a while that I will be able to just start the podcast without any preface. Let's just get into it. First up, I didn't expect that there would be another update on exoplanets just a month after my last update in January. You may remember that I told you guys about the first Earth-sized exoplanets reported by Dr. David Charbonneau orbiting around the star Kepler-20. It was an important find, but those new planets in the Kepler system were all too close to the actual star to be in the life zone around it. And so, they were too hot for life, and or were not likely to have any water on them. Well, a new report was published at the beginning of February in Astrophysical Journal Letters that has discovered a planet smack dab in the life zone on the star GJ667C. The article was written by astrophysicist Dr. Guillaume Anglada Escuda of the University of Göttingen and his team at the High Accuracy Radial Velocity Precision Searcher, known as HARPS, in Switzerland. That is one of the major centers for exoplanet searches, by the way. The new paper reports three planets in the system that is only 22 light-years from Earth, in the Scorpius constellation. Dr. Steve Vogt of University of California, Santa Cruz, and one of the co-authors of the paper, says of the planets, quote, "The closest in planet zooms around the star once every 7.2 days, making it a well-lit charcoal briquette. The second planet, the one of interest in the life zone, is a relative dawdler taking 28.15 days to complete an orbit. And the third signature seems to be a planet on a 75-day orbit, but it could also just be an artifact of the star's activity." Unquote. The star system is not like Earth's insofar as GJ667C is a red dwarf and not a yellow sun. A red dwarf, if you don't remember, is dimmer and cooler than Sol is. Because it is dimmer and cooler, that means that the habitable life zone is much closer to the star itself than we're used to in our own solar system. It means that planets that are snuggled much closer in are not as hot as they would be in a yellow star system, but they're still in the life zone. Unfortunately, the news is not quite as exciting as it could be. The second planet of the GJ667C system is not an Earth-sized planet. It's another one of those exoplanets that fall into the super-Earth category. It's 4.5 times bigger than Earth, or even a bit more. The authors of the paper are cautious about one thing. They do remind everyone that until we get better and newer instrumentation in the future, there is no way to actually know more about the likelihood of life on that planet in the GJ667C star system or others like it. It may or may not be habitable, just because it is in the life zone. But, quote, "It's difficult to determine habitability without knowing the planet's composition or anything about its atmosphere and how much of the star's energy is absorbed," unquote. However, given their less than optimistic attitude, the authors still insist that finding this planet in a life zone is just the beginning and there will be lots more coming up in the near future. I'll certainly keep you posted on that. Next up, coffee. What else can this miracle drink do? Well, actually, it's been known for quite a while that heavy coffee drinkers have a reduced chance of getting diabetes type 2. Papers over the past decade or so have demonstrated quite clearly, and without doubt, that people who drink four or more cups of coffee each day have up to a 50% lower risk of the disease, with each additional cup associated with a further 7% drop in risk. So the question over the last 10 years has been, what exactly is the connection between coffee and diabetes? It does seem like rather an odd one. Dr. Biao Cheng and his colleagues at Wuhan University in China just published a paper in the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry late December on how this effect actually works. The researchers found that coffee influences the misfolding of a protein in the pancreas called human amyloid polypeptide, HIAPP. This protein is implicated in causing type 2 diabetes. According to the paper, certain compounds in coffee significantly inhibited the formation of this toxic amyloid compound, which likely explains the lowered risk of diabetes type 2 in coffee lovers. Here is just a quick reminder about protein structure and misfolding. Proteins are made of long strands of molecules called amino acids. There are 20 standard amino acids that are used in every organism on the face of the Earth. Proteins function in part by having a very specific folded structure when all the different amino acids in a strand chemically interact. If a protein does not fold in that particular way, then it will probably lose its activity and not function. Hence, the implication of protein misfolding in this coffee paper. The researchers examined the various active components of coffee to see what might account for the anti-diabetes effect. Coffee extracts have three major active components: caffeine, which we all know about, caffeic acid, and chlorogenic acid. In this study, the effects of these major coffee components were studied, as well as dihydrocaffeic acid, which is a major metabolite of chlorogenic acid and caffeic acid. The study found that caffeic acid and chlorogenic acid significantly suppress the formation of HIAPP oligomers, whereas caffeine showed no significant effect on oligomerization. That last part kind of makes sense, since other drinks like Coke or Pepsi or black tea, which do have caffeine, have never been shown to reduce the risk of diabetes. Yes, that includes Jolt Cola, which I suspect has no health benefits at all. So the next time somebody annoys you about your coffee addiction, just tell them that you are getting your daily recommended doses of caffeic and chlorogenic acids. Next story. In my past science podcasts over the last several years, you may have heard me saying that the $1,000 human genome was near. Well, it has finally arrived. It is here, and the world will be changing soon. Well, for better or worse, I don't know which, but the game is certainly going to be changing. Two competing companies in the last month have started offering for sale machines capable of sequencing a human genome in 24 hours rather than weeks or months. Illumina Inc. and Life Technologies Corp. both announced the launch of their respective machines, each capable of speed reading a genome in a single day. And the Life Technologies machine will do that for $1,000 per genome. Yes, you heard that right. Your whole genome sequenced in just one day for just $1,000. The Illumina HiSeq 2500 will allow researchers to generate 120 gigabases of data. That's a 40-fold coverage of the genome. That means that the machine can sequence a single 3-gigabase human genome 40 times in only 27 hours. That is a significant increase in speed over the previous model. The popular HiSeq 2000 machine made by Illumina, which sequences up to 5 human genomes, that's about 600 gigabases of data, simultaneously over 10 days. But the charming and attractive new 2500 model comes with a hefty price tag of $740,000. So no, it's not likely I'll be picking one up for my lab very soon. The Life Technologies Ion Proton Sequencer is slightly more my style for the price and is significantly lower at $149,000. Life Technologies machine will sequence an entire human genome with a 20 to 30 fold coverage in just a day for, as I said, $1,000. That seems like a pretty good deal. Life Technologies' $1,000 estimated price per genome includes the consumables needed for template preparation, amplification, and sequencing, as well as the cost of the solid-state sequencing chips that the machine employs. I suspect that Illumina has not gotten to the price break of $1,000 yet per genome because they have continually declined to disclose a cost per genome for their HiSeq 2500. You cannot find it anywhere in their literature, and if you call the company and are not a serious buyer, they will not discuss such costs with you. I guess my lack of $750,000 makes me not a serious buyer. Remember that the magical $1,000 per genome number is important because that's the number that most insurance companies have agreed that they will be happy to pay for their clients to have their genome sequenced. The sequencing industry reports that the cost of sequencing has dropped 33% per quarter since 2007. Sequencing is becoming so cheap that its cost could soon be the least of genomics research expenses, which include the cost of acquiring the sample, preparing the sample, and post-sequencing bioinformatic analysis of your genome. And remember, it is not cheap to analyze 3 billion base pairs for deleterious effects, even if it is cheap to get those 3 billion base pairs in the first place. After my soapbox speech last month in favor of using adult stem cells in disease therapy over embryonic stem cells, you would think that the next story would just thrill me. Well, thrill is not quite the correct word. Horrify, perhaps, but not thrill. It was reported in the news section of the journal Biotechniques that an assistant professor at the Medical University of South Carolina has been accused by federal authorities of using university resources to produce stem cells for illegal treatment. The U.S. Federal Drug Administration has been arresting a variety of people over the last year for selling illicit stem cell therapies. For the first time, they have charged an actual medical researcher at a university. Dr. Vincent DeMai, an assistant professor in the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at the Medical University of South Carolina, is one of four men named in recent indictments. The federal indictments charged the group with operating a ring that offered unauthorized stem cell treatments for a whole set of diseases: cancer, Lou Gehrig's disease, MS, and a bunch of other autoimmune diseases. The government says that DeMai used university facilities to produce stem cells from umbilical cord blood collected at a maternity clinic in Del Rio, Texas. The stem cells that were collected were then sold illegally by a company called Global Laboratories, headquartered in Scottsdale, Arizona. Also named as defendants in the case are Jesus Alberto Ramon, a midwife at a maternity clinic where the umbilical cord material was allegedly procured; Lawrence Stowe, charged with promoting and selling stem cell cures; and Francesco Morales, an unlicensed physician. The FDA says that Morales performed the procedures at a clinic in Mexico and falsely represented to the public that he was a physician licensed to practice medicine in the U.S. The Medical University of South Carolina said it first got word in 2010 that one of its faculty members may have been involved in an illicit stem cell operation, and that it's been investigating since it first got word of this. Now the school has announced that it has, quote, placed Dr. DeMai on administrative leave pending the resolution of the matter. His laboratory and office have been locked and secured, unquote. The medical school also made a public statement that, quote, the federal authorities have affirmed that the alleged stem cell work was conducted without knowledge of the medical university, and they made no allegations of any inappropriate activity on the part of the university, unquote. Sick people get desperate, and these medical researchers taking financial advantage of distressed people is rather horrifying. Even if these guys were doing the treatments with the best of intentions of helping their fellow human beings, it's still wrong from almost every scientific perspective that you can think of to use stem cell therapy if you're uncertain of the results. I refer you to the recent Rise of the Planet of the Apes movie. James Franco's lack of scientific forethought led to dire consequences, which I will not spoil for those of you who haven't seen the movie. I don't believe that DeMai and company's work would have led to such a calamitous end, but it could have potentially worsened lives where suffering was already present. Even putting the best face on it, these people were just plain negligent. Probably the worst part about the whole situation is that it may just be a hint of a whole hidden industry out there taking advantage of sick people that we really know very little or nothing about. Next story. What is the oldest living organism? Well, that may seem like a simple question, but it may not be quite as simple as it sounds. Most people would tell you that the bristlecone pine in the western mountains of North America are the most ancient organisms alive. That is, on the order of 4,500 to 5,000 years old. That means, by the way, that some of those pines have actually been on Earth throughout all of recorded human history, which is a bit sobering. Now, if you define the oldest organisms by the oldest organism which has continually been alive by cloning itself over massive amounts of time, well, then the bristlecone pine is just a piker. An article published this week in the biology journal PLOS ONE suggests that the seagrass, Posidonia oceanica, may be the oldest living clonal organism on the face of the Earth. The lead author on the report is Dr. Sophie Arnaud-Heond of the Universidade do Algarve in Portugal. The paper reports that clonal Posidonia oceanica plants were found all over the Mediterranean Sea. The distances between populations range from meters to hundreds of kilometers. These plants flower rather rarely, and most of their reproduction occurs by putting out rhizomes and spreading through a meadow non-sexually. The researchers used genetic markers to examine 1,544 samples from a total of 40 locations across the Mediterranean Sea. Their analysis of all the common markers revealed the presence, with a prevalence of 3.5 to 8.9%, of very large clones spreading over 1 to 15 square kilometers at the different locations. Based on growth estimates of these very slow-growing plants that seldom flower, the authors estimated that it would take anywhere between 12,000 to 100,000 years to cover the areas that some of the beds of seagrasses actually covered. The authors got their results by combining genetics, demography, and model-based calculations. Since their methods and results are quite new, they question our present knowledge and understanding of the spreading capacity and lifespan of plant clones. They say in the paper that, quote, "These findings call for further research on life history traits associated with clonality, considering their possible ecological and evolutionary implications," unquote. The implication of the age of these grass clones suggests that the original clone from which all of the present-day clones arose was out in the Mediterranean while Homo sapiens were still mostly isolated to their original birthplace in Africa, and Neanderthals still roamed the earth. Now that is pretty ancient. The last story of the night concerns zebras and the basic physical feature of zebras that every one of us has known since we were toddlers. Zebras have stripes. But have you ever wondered why zebras have stripes? As with most things in nature, we often just accept them as we see them. Elephants have big trunks, giraffes have long necks, rhinos have big horns on their noses, etc. It's very often only children who ask why. Why does an elephant have a trunk? Why do giraffes have long necks, but hippos have short necks? You get my drift. But why stripes? What advantage do stripes have for a zebra? Certainly black and white is not a camouflage thing. Black and white doesn't exactly blend in on the African savanna. Or, well, maybe does it. Maybe not if you're hiding from a lion, but the stripes may help out with other predators. Where am I going with this? Dr. Gabor Horvath and colleagues from Hungary and Sweden have published a paper this month in the Journal of Experimental Biology that may finally explain the purpose of the zebra's stripes, as well as other stripes on animals in Africa. Horseflies deliver wicked bites. They carry diseases and distract grazing animals from feeding. According to the paper, these insects are attracted to horizontally polarized light because reflections from water are horizontally polarized. And aquatic insects use this phenomenon to identify stretches of water where they can mate and lay eggs. However, blood-sucking female horseflies are also guided to victims by linearly polarized light reflected from their hides. The paper points out that horseflies are more attracted and prefer dark horses to white horses. The paper then goes on to point out that developing zebra embryos start out with dark skin, but then go on to develop white stripes. The team wondered whether the zebra's stripy hide might have evolved to disrupt their attractive dark skins and make them less appealing to ravenous, blood-sucking flies. The team tested how attractive the flies found black and white striped patterns of varying widths, densities, and angles of the stripes. They did this by painting white stripes on dark surfaces around a horse farm and looking to see what attracted the flies the most. Onto the painted surface, they trapped the attracted flies with oil and glue. The paper reports that the patterns attracted fewer flies as the stripes became narrower, with the narrowest stripes attracting the fewest flies. The team then tested the attractiveness of white, dark, and striped models of horses. The researchers hypothesized that the striped horse would attract an intermediate number of flies between the white and dark models. However, they were surprised to find that the striped model was the least attractive of all. When the researchers went back and measured the stripe widths and polarization patterns of light reflected from real zebra hides, they found that the zebra's pattern correlated well with the patterns that were least attracted to horseflies. Here is their conclusion from the paper. Quote, "We conclude that zebras have evolved a coat pattern in which the stripes are narrow enough to ensure minimum attractiveness to tabanid flies, that is horseflies. The selection pressure for striped coat patterns as a response to blood-sucking dipteran parasites is probably high in Africa, unquote. These results would also explain the striped pattern on a quagga. What is a quagga, you say? Well, it's an extinct brown and white relative of the zebra. This may be a bit of a detour, but the quagga was originally classified as an individual species in 1778. Over the next 200 years or so after that, many other zebras were described by naturalists and explorers. Because of the great variation in coat patterns, no two zebras are alike, I guess like snowflakes, taxonomists were left with a great number of described species and no easy way to tell which of these were actual species, which were subspecies, and which were simply natural variants of the same species. So they weren't quite sure about whether the quagga was a species or not at that point. Well, long before that confusion about quaggas was sorted out, the quagga became a victim of extinction. It was hunted regrettably for its meat, hide, and to preserve feed for domesticated stock, which the poor quagga stole from. The last quagga was probably shot in the late 1870s, and the last specimen in captivity, a mare, died on August 12, 1883, at the Natura Artis Magistra Zoo in Amsterdam. Because of the confusion between different zebra species, the quagga was extinct before anybody even realized officially that it was actually a separate species. But now, even though the quagga is long gone, we know why it had a striped hide. Very sad. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care, keep pounding down that Java, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.